So we're in a series of thinking about Psalms, and so today we're going to look at Psalm 104. And Psalm 104, well, I'm going to say it's an interesting hymn, but I realize they're all interesting hymns. So, but this sort of Psalm 104 is this interesting poem here, and we can start sort of towards the end, down in verse 34, right? What the psalmist writes is, "May my meditation be pleasing to you." And there's something really interesting about that idea that at the end of this poem, right, this end of this song, right, the psalmist is saying, "May my meditation be pleasing to you," because that's the way to read this psalm, right? It's a meditation. And in fact, that's one of the important things about poetry in general, right? It took me a long time to figure out poetry. And so one of the problems with poetry for me was you sit down and you're reading lots of stuff. You read economic stuff, right? And you just sort of plow through it like it's a death march, right? It's fascinating and all, but it's not well written for the most part. And so you sort of just plow through all this stuff. And you read novels and you're sort of trying to read to the end to find out who done it or something like that. And then you turn to poems and you just sit down and you just start reading them really fast, and then they're not that long, and then you sort of hit the end like, what the heck was that? And then you move on to another one and so on. And the whole trick of poetry is to realize, well, it's not a sort of philosophical tract. It's not a novel. It's something that's meant to be meditated on. If you read a poem and you read a poem once, you have not read the poem, right? To read a poem, you have to read it, and then you have to reread it, and then you read it again, and then you read it again. And some poems you read over a lifetime, and sometime 30 or 40 years later, it finally snaps into focus, kind of thing. And the Psalms have that feel, right? There's some of them that are very readable on a free, you know, you read it the first time, you think, oh, I got that. But then as you meditate on them, you sort of just go over it, and then you read it, and then you notice this, and then you notice a line there you never noticed before, and you start noticing more and more things as you sort of read it slowly and paying attention to what's going on. That's the idea of the meditation. And this psalm is designed as something one meditates about. It's something one sort of reads to sort of just notice what's going on slowly is what's going on. So that's what we're going to do today. We're going to meditate on Psalm 104. And so we can look at the Psalms, and then the other thing that's worth reminding ourselves of is, I've noted before, Hebrew poetry is unlike English poetry in lots of ways, right? So Hebrew poetry has no rhyme scheme or rhythm patterns, right? What makes Hebrew poetry is all the lines come in either pairs and occasionally a sort of trio, right? And that's sort of the clever thing the poet does, right? So instead of having these paired lines, sometimes it's three in a row that are all related together. And they're all like there's a thought, and then the second line is like amplifying the thought or echoing the thought or, you know, expanding on the thought or something like that. That's what makes the poem a poem, right? Is it's just sort of this gradual repetition type of idea. So Psalm 104, first stanza, it begins this way. Bless the Lord, O my soul. And that first line is really important all by itself. This is the introduction to the idea. So what is this poem going to be? It starts with, bless the Lord, O my soul. Now that's, you know, that's one of those phrases we say all the time, right? Oh, bless the Lord, right? But you think about bless the Lord, it's sort of odd, right? If somebody blesses you, right, they're making you happy, right? They're doing something to bring a blessing to you. Blessed are those, right? Happy are those, right? You're blessing someone. And then this poem is the poet blessing God. Now, that's an odd idea, right? What can we do to make God happy, right? What could we do to be a blessing, or how do we bless God? Well, this is how we bless God. We bless God with Psalm 104. Bless the Lord, O my soul. And then the first stanza. O Lord my God, you are very great. You are clothed with splendor and majesty, covering yourself with light as with a garment, stretching out the heavens like a tent. He lays the beams of his chambers on the waters. He makes the clouds his chariot. He rides on the wings of the wind. He makes his messengers winds. He ministers a flaming fire. And this first stanza has a number of really interesting features. The first thing is right up at the front, right? O Lord my God, you are very great. You are clothed with splendor and majesty. And if you just heard that, right, just stop there. Think of the image that comes up here. You've got the Lord who's very great, who is clothed in splendor and majesty. And if you think of a lord or a ruler clothed in splendor and majesty, what do you imagine? Well, you imagine all of those kingly robes, right? I mean, that's what it means to be splendid. I mean, you've got gold everywhere, and the robes are really dyed beautiful colors, and it's expensive, and there's a crown, and all of these things. And so God, he's saying, is God is up there. He's very great. He's clothed in splendor and majesty, just like all the emperors, you're thinking, just like all the great kings of the earth. But then, clothed in splendor and majesty, wrapping yourself in light as with a garment. Now think about the image there. We get rid of all of those rich trappings, and what is God clothed with? He's clothed in light, which is like the most ephemeral kind of thing. Like there's nothing heavy about it. I mean, it's just sort of imagining this light as the garment covering God. It's bright, it's amazing, and it is utterly unlike what we imagined, right? You're now imagining this great emperor who is clothed in nothing but light, wrapped in light like a garment. And it is a striking image. I mean, and so this is one of the things poets do, right? They sort of just flip it all, and suddenly you imagine being wrapped in light. And then light, you remember, is pretty interesting in Old Testament narrative. In the beginning, God says, "Let there be light." And suddenly we have this image of God wrapped in light. And then begins this series that sort of, it becomes a little bit awkward to translate. And so the translators have a hard time with it. There's no pronouns in this. The way it really would read is something like, wrapped in light, right, as with a garment, stretching out the heavens as a tent, laying the beams of his chamber on waters, making the clouds his chariot, riding on the wings of the wind, making his messengers the winds. It's all this very active, right? He is wrapping, he is riding, he is clothing, you know, all of these things, just one after another, just sort of this repetitive pattern. And then you notice sort of what he's doing here. He's doing all these things, laying the beams of his chambers on the waters. And that, again, is a weird image, right? You're imagining you're laying the beams of a chamber, but you don't lay them on water. But then remember, what is the water here? Well, again, you go back to the creation narrative, and right away what God does after he's created light is he separates the waters above from the waters below. So laying the beams of his chamber, he's laying them in the heavens. In the water above, there's now these beams, and there's these beams for God's chambers up above, and here he is riding a chariot. He's riding his chariot, but his chariots are the clouds, and his messengers are the winds. And by the end of this, what we have is we have this image of God up in the heavens, wrapped in light, riding on clouds, sending his messengers out like the winds, right? His beams are up there. And we have this very heavenly image of God, which seems like an appropriate way to think about God. God is up there in his heavens, and it's magisterial, and it's amazing, and the poet is looking up, and he's just seeing this God wrapped in light, riding on the clouds, and all of these things. And then the second stanza becomes a jarring grounding. We've had this whole thing thinking about God up there with all of these things, and then immediately thereafter, he set the earth on its foundations so that it should never be moved. You covered it with the deep as with a garment. The waters stood above the mountains. At your rebuke, they fled. At the sound of your thunder, they took to flight. The mountains rose, the valleys sank down to the place that you appointed for them. You set a boundary that they may not pass, so that they might not again cover the earth. And so here we have, right, we've got this image of God, but then suddenly it's all grounded here on this earth. And then what is God doing here on this earth? Well, this is a mashup of the creation story and the flood story, all sort of mashed together in this one giant narrative, right? And then what's happening here, as you imagine, we've got this sort of earth thing. It's covered in the waters, right? You covered it with the deep as with a garment, right? So the mountains are clothed in water. God was clothed in light. The mountains are all clothed in water. And then what is he doing? He rebukes the waters, and they all flee from the land, right? And so again, this is the creation story. The earth is covered in water. And then he separates the water and the land emerges. It's the flood story. The earth is covered with waters, and he pours out the waters, and then the waters dry up, and the land emerges. And we've suddenly got this land all emerging. The waters have all been put into their place. And what's fascinating about this is this is a deliberate play, oh, certainly deliberate play, on old Canaanite mythology, right? You look at the mythology of all the nations around it, and one of the things that happens in all these sort of mythologies of the time is there is this giant sea god, Yom, right? And Yom turns out to be the Hebrew word for ocean too, right? And what Yom does is he comes and he's flooding the earth, and then the good gods have to constantly fight back Yom, right? Imagine there's this primordial battle kind of thing between the water god who's constantly flooding the earth and then the good gods who are constantly driving this evil water god or sea god away, right? One of the earlier Psalms, Psalm 74, right, has this great moment where sort of God splits the sea god, right? He sort of, it's got this whole imagery of God just destroying the sea god. And so you imagine writing that psalm and in the land of Canaan, right? And you can just imagine sort of all, oh, God took out the sea god kind of thing, right? But the poet here is doing something really fascinating with that, because this is not a poem about God fighting the sea god. There is no sea god here. Who caused the waters to show up in the first place? Oh, God put the waters there in the first place. And then God rebukes the waters and makes them flee to their appropriate places. This isn't God versus somebody. This is God who is in total control of this, right? The earth is floods, and then he drives the water away. And that's why it's so interesting that because this mashup of the creation and the flood story, in the creation story, God creates the world, right? It's got the waters separated above and below. The waters are covering the earth, and then he causes the dry land to come forth. And then God, in the flood story, floods the earth, and then God dries the earth up. And so what we have here is a poet who is taking what everybody would have expected this poem to be and turning it into a huge story about how God is in control of both the floods and the fact that the waters are now receded, and they are receded to the point, right, at the end of this stanza, right, so that they might not again cover the earth, which was exactly the end of the rainbow, with the rainbow at the end of the flood story. God causes the waters to retreat, sets the rainbow, promising it will never get flooded again, and God is here in control of this all. The oceans are now receded, the dry land has appeared, but this creates an immediate problem. If all the water is over in the ocean and all the land doesn't have the water in it, this is going to be a pretty barren land. Then the next stanza, you make your springs gush forth in the valleys. They flow between the hills. They give drink to every beast of the field. The wild donkeys quench their thirst. Beside them, the birds of the heavens dwell. They sing among the branches. From your lofty abode, you water the mountains. The earth is satisfied with the fruit of your work. The oceans have been pushed back, the water's all pushed back, but then suddenly there's still water in the land. And where is the water coming from? It's gushing up from the earth, right? That's the beginning. You make the springs gush forth in the valleys, so the water is coming up, and then from your lofty abode you water the mountains. From God, who, remember, the clouds were his chariots up above, is watering the land. The rain is coming, so the water is coming from below, the water is coming from above, and suddenly there's water in the dry land, but it's all in its appointed places, right? They're flowing between the hills, and then the water is doing something pretty extraordinary. The water is providing for all of these beasts of the field. And you'll notice it's the wild donkey, not the tamed donkey. And it's not birds, just birds. It's birds of the heavens. You've got all these creatures out there that are undomesticated. They're free. They're wandering around, right? And you imagine the wild donkey. Who gives a wild donkey water? Like, doesn't a wild donkey lack for water? Oh, no, the wild donkey doesn't lack for water because God has provided water for wild donkeys. God has provided water and places to shelter for the birds of the heavens, right? And suddenly we've got this image now that God is doing all of these things here. He's pushed the oceans back. He's watering the land so that all of these wild creatures have enough water. They have places to reside, right? And so we've got now a beautiful image. If the poem just stopped here, this would be a great story of God just creating a magnificent natural world where all of these things are happening out there, right? Suddenly there's waters gushing around, the animals are feeding and drinking, and there's a beautiful picture here that God has orchestrated all of this. But then there's more. You cause the grass to grow for the livestock and plants for man to cultivate, that he may bring forth food from the earth, and wine to gladden the heart of man, oil to make his face shine, and bread to strengthen man's heart. It's not just the wild donkeys and the birds of the heavens that God is providing for. He is providing all the grass for the livestock. The domesticated animals now have places to graze. And God is providing food for people, right? Suddenly there are plants for man to cultivate, to grow. You can now be a farmer here on this land. It's not just a wild land with wild animals. It's also a place that man can live and it can cultivate plants. And there's grass there for livestock. And then he has all this food coming from the earth. And he's got the wine and the oil and the bread, and what are they doing? The wine is gladdening the hearts of men. The oil is making his face shine, and the bread is strengthening man's heart. And suddenly there's all of this food that's doing all these amazing things, right? It's good to be joyful. It's good to have strong hearts. And then you get the oil line, which I'll be honest, is a little weird, right? You know, the oil to make his face shine. So there's two ways to read this. One is that's what it is, right? And we're really glad about oil because it gives us shiny faces, right? And maybe shiny faces are really good, right? And this is one of these things, I just don't know, right? Like, is it good to have a shiny face, right? I spent forever trying to figure this out and you end up with lots of makeup ads, right? And so I have no idea if shiny faces are good or not, right? But if they are, then it's great. God has provided the oil so we can have shiny faces. But it turns out there's another perfectly appropriate way to translate this from the Hebrew, and it's that it's wine to gladden the hearts of man and make his face shine brighter than oil. And that I like better, right? That seems to be a much nicer translation, partly because I don't understand the shiny face thing, right? But imagine it. So that's what it is. He's providing wine to gladden the hearts of man and make his face shine so that it's brighter than oil, and bread to strengthen man's heart. And if that's what this is saying, it's got another extraordinary thing here. What are the two foods that are being mentioned here? Wine and bread, which has some really interesting theological significance, right? And so here's a poet, long before Jesus, right, writing this poem, and if you read it, the oil is sort of just the comparison thing. He's saying God has done all these amazing things, and one of the things he's done is he's provided wine and bread, and then later on we find out wine and bread are these giant symbols of Christ, and this suddenly has all sorts of fascinating Christological overtones that the poet would have had no idea about, right? He's just sort of mentioning wine and bread, because honestly, you're living in this time, right? You want to be happy. You want to be well-fed. You want wine. You want bread. These are the staples of life, right? Or this has this magnificent overtones here. But in either case, God is providing these things. He's providing for all of these people. And then he goes on, the trees of the Lord are watered abundantly. The cedars of Lebanon that he planted, in them the birds build their nests. The stork has her home in the fir trees. The high mountains are for the wild goats. The rocks are a refuge for the rock badgers. And this whole stanza is saying, okay, we've got this whole world now that God's created us all, and everything has its place. Everything has a place here on this world, right? We've got the trees of the Lord that are watered abundantly. The great trees are drinking their fill. And then the example is the cedars of Lebanon that he planted. Now, the cedars of Lebanon, they show up a lot in the Old Testament because they were really important trees. But the interesting thing about the cedars of Lebanon is they can get old, right? Cedars of Lebanon can hit 1,000 years, right? I mean, so these can be old trees. They're big. And you imagine there's these trees you know about that are 1,000 years old. Well, you don't really know they're 1,000 years old. This is what you know. When you were a kid, they were already really, really big. And not only that, when your parents were kids, they were really, really big. And when your parents' parents were kids, everybody knows these are just really big trees. Where do really big trees come from? God planted the really big trees. God put the really big trees right there. And not only are the really big trees there because God planted them, right? They're there so that the birds will have a home. They can live in really big trees. The stork can live in the fir trees. There's high mountains out there. High mountains are great for wild goats. That's where they live. There's rocks out there. Those are great for rock badgers. Everything has a home here. The world's got all this variety. It's got all this variety of landscapes and habitats, and there's all these different animals all living in these different habitats because God has created all these different places for all these different creatures to live. But it's not just having all these places. He's also created all these times that are different. He made the moon to mark the seasons. The sun knows its time for setting. You make darkness, and it is night, when all the beasts of the forest creep about. The young lions roar for their prey, seeking their food from God. When the sun rises, they steal away and lie down in their dens. Man goes out to his work and to his labor until the evening. So we've got all these sort of, everything has its place, but then everything also has its time. The moon is up there to mark all these seasons, right? There's different times through the year. But not only is it just the seasons through the year, there's also the nighttime and the daytime. And they're really different. Different things happen at nighttime and daytime. And this, again, becomes the poet doing a marvelous thing with another great poem written not by, it's not in the Psalms, right? It was written by one of the pharaohs, Akhenaten. And Akhenaten, Pharaoh Akhenaten, is a sort of interesting pharaoh in Egyptian history, right? So this is a little bit of a side note, right? But it's important, right? So the Egyptians, we all know, had this pantheon of gods. And there arose this one pharaoh, Akhenaten, who was a monotheist, right? Rocked through Egypt like no tomorrow, right? Because he says, basically, there's just one god up there and so on. And so he's long predating everybody here, right? And he's saying, oh, there's just this one god up there. And Egyptian society has a hard time knowing what to do with this guy. And he's up there and he's doing all these things. He's a really important guy if you're just reading Egyptian history. And one of the things he wrote was a hymn to Aten. And Aten is the sun god. And he writes this poem about the sun god. And the sun god isn't one of the gods. The sun god is the manifestation of the true God, right? So there's one god up there, and the sun is how he manifests himself. And in this hymn to Aten, right, there are an enormous number of parallels between this old Egyptian poem and Psalm 104. And this is where academics are wonderful, right? You look at academics, and you get this giant debate among academics, right? There's a whole set of academics who look at it and say, look, they're basically the same, right? Look at all the parallels. See, they're basically the same poem, and Psalm 104 is clearly just based on the hymn to the sun here. And then another set of academics looks at it and says, no. They're basically different, right? They're not really, I mean, they're a lot of similarity, but they're basically different. So here's your debate. Are they basically the same or basically different? Turns out to be one of those huge things you can spend your whole career arguing about if you want to be an academic, or it's something we can note, there's a lot of similarities, right? But they're not identical. What a shocking conclusion, right? And so you have him on this hymn to the sun, but one of the things that happens in the hymn to the sun is the lion bit. The lions, you'll note here, the young lions roar for their prey, seeking their food from God. When the sun rises, they steal away, they lie down in their dens. In the hymn to the sun, when the sun goes down in this hymn, the lions come out as this marauding, terrible thing. It turns out if you're living near lions, they're scary, right? And so when the sun goes away, the lions come out. The scorpions come out, right? But the lions come out, and they're roaring, and they're terrible. But then the sun comes back and terrifies away all the lions, and they go away. And so if you're reading that thing, right, that's a nice message, right? That when the sun goes down, the sun god goes away, night takes over, all the horrible things come out. But one of the great things about sun is it comes back the next day and scares all the horrible things away. That would be a nice message. But notice what this poet is doing with that message. The sun god, or God who's represented by the sun, isn't going away. You make darkness, is what the poet says. It's not God makes sun, and then when God sort of vanishes for a bit, all these horrible lions come out. No, God makes the darkness. Why? So the lions have a time they can come out and get the food God has prepared for him. And what's really great is the food that God prepared for the lions isn't you, right? You are supposed to be home asleep at night, right? And then when you wake up in the morning and it's daylight, the lions have gone to bed, and now you get to go out and do your day's work. So instead of this image of a sun vanishing and all the terrible things coming out, Oh no, there's a time for lions. There's a time for scorpions to come out. And they come out in their time, and then they go away, and then it's your time, and you get to go out. And who's in charge of all of this? God's in charge of all of this. It's extraordinary. Oh, Lord, how manifold are your works, is what he says next. And you can see why at this point. If you've been reading and meditating on this, this is an amazing world. How manifold are your works. In wisdom, you have made them all. The earth is full of your creatures, or full of your creations, or full of your riches. Here is the sea, great and wide, which teems with creatures innumerable, living things, both small and great. There go the ships and Leviathan, which you formed to play in it. And suddenly you realize this world is so big, right? The ancient Israel, right? It was not a seafaring nation. You imagine you're sort of a nation that has got to sea a lot, but then you're looking at the oceans. And God's just extending way beyond the land. God is out there, and the oceans are also full of all these creatures. And they're not only full, the sea's out there, and the ships are going out onto this giant ocean. It is great, and it is wide, and it is magnificent. And there goes the ships and Leviathan, which should send shudders through your soul. Because when the ships go out, Leviathan is the great sea monster. A lion is a terrifying sea monster out there in the sea. We know this from all the mythologies, right? All these stories of Leviathan out there. And so the ships are going out, and there's Leviathan. And now Leviathan often gets, I mean, that's how I learned it, right? Leviathan, I mean, I don't think, oh, it's just whales, right? Because we don't like the idea that there were sea monsters once upon a time. So they're just whales. But I always had a problem with this. Like, whales aren't scary, right? I mean, so yeah, they're big things, and they're floating around, but they move slow, and they make noises, and there was a great Star Trek movie about them, and so on. But whales are not these terrifying things. But then I realized, this is the first time I've ever realized in my life this, right? Janet, who is obsessed with these creatures, right, sent me this story about killer whales attacking ships in the Mediterranean. The whales, Leviathan, is an orca. It's a killer whale, right? And you can totally see why everyone would be terrified of these orcas, right? Pliny the Elder, who's a rough contemporary of Paul, he was a Roman, he wrote an Encyclopedia of Nature, right? And in the Encyclopedia of Nature, he gets to talk about the orcas, right? And he says they're really hard to describe, but they are an enormous mass of savage flesh with teeth. That's how he describes them. An enormous mass of savage flesh with teeth. These are scary things. And the ships go out, and there's orcas, right? There's savage masses of savage flesh with teeth. Like, I love that. Savage flesh with teeth, right? It's not a matter of that. Savage flesh with teeth, right? And you're out there, and the ships are going out. Oh, but wait a minute. What is Leviathan doing out there? Leviathan isn't out there attacking ships at all, right? God made Leviathan. He made this ocean. He formed the killer whales to play in the ocean. You go out in a boat, and you see these giant, and they're just out there playing. This is what they're doing. They're just out there having a merry time, dashing around. And it turns out they hunt animals just for sport, right? They don't even eat them, right? I mean, they really are, but they're just having fun. It's like a mouse toying, you know, being toyed with by a cat. And there's the killer whale toying with the walrus and sea lions or whatever they have there, right? And so on, right? And so they're sort of out there, but they also have their place in this world. Even all the scary things have their place and their role in all of this. And then they all look to you to give them their food in due season. When you give it to them, they gather it up. When you open your hand, they are filled with good things. When you hide your face, they are dismayed. When you take away their breath, they die and return to their dust. When you send forth your spirit, they are created, and you renew the face of the ground. And when you're in the end, and you sort of see the poet here is providing this grand wrap-up here, right? Everything is looking to God to give them food in due season. And then the rest of the stanza is this whole comparison of these are the things God does and these are the things the creatures do. And what does God do? He gives food to them. He opens his hand. He hides his face. He takes away their breath. He sends forth his spirit and he renews the face of the ground. That's what God is doing, right? He is giving and opening his hand. He's hiding his face. He's taking away their breath, sending forth his spirit, and renewing. That's what God does. And then what are we doing, creatures are doing, right? We gather up the food. We are filled with things. We are dismayed. We die and return to dust. And we are created. And what you have here is a God who's doing all the action here. And then all the creatures are just responding to the action. And you'll notice what's really interesting about this is this bit about that he takes away their breath and he sends forth your spirit. And I only catch this because we did a sermon for a couple weeks back about the Holy Spirit. Breath and spirit are the same word here. And what is God doing? He's sending forth his spirit so things are born. He's taking away his spirit so things die. And this is all natural and orderly. But what's really amazing about the way the poet does this is he has the wrong order, it seems. Do you create and be born or die first? I mean, we know it should be you created and then you take away your breath and you die. But it's the other way around here. He takes away their breath and they die and return to dust. But then he sends forth his spirit and they're created and renewed the face of the ground. Our perspective in all these things is you're born and then you die, and then beginning and then end. But that's not the way this is working. It's this constant cycle. Things die, they return to dust, and new things are born and rise up. And those things die as something else comes along. We are so human-centric for some weird reason, right? We just think of ourselves as being born and dying, right? But you imagine all the other created things. You look out at trees right now. They're lost their leaves. They look dead, but they'll be back in spring. Because that's what God is doing. He's renewing constantly this earth. It wasn't just a one-time creation that runs its way till it all dies off. He's constantly watching the death because he created all of the end, but then he's creating the renewals and it comes back and we are here and God opens his hands and we get our fill and then God turns away his face and we're dismayed, takes away his breath and we die, but then there'll be a whole new cycle of creation and renewal over and over. And then the final stanza, may the glory of the Lord endure forever. You get the forever here. It's been hinted at in the last one. May the glory of the Lord endure forever. May the Lord rejoice in his works. Who looks on the earth and it trembles. Who touches the mountains and they smoke. And we'll pause there, right? So what's going on here? We're praying that the glory of the Lord will endure forever. And the Lord will rejoice in his works. God made all of this stuff, and God is rejoicing about how amazing it is. He's rejoicing so much, he looks at the earth, and there's earthquakes. The earth is so excited, it trembles. He touches the earth, and there's volcanoes bursting forth from the earth because it's so excited. The earth is excited here that God has made all this. God is rejoicing. The earth is rejoicing in all of these things. I will sing to the Lord as long as I live. I will sing praise to my God while I have being. And if you're thinking about all of this amazing stuff, what's your reaction? It's to sing. Because this is amazing. This is extraordinary. This is the kind of thing that you just start thinking about this world and your heart should be like those volcanoes. Your flesh should be like those earthquakes. You should be trembling and bursting forth in song. May my meditations be pleasing to him, for I rejoice in the Lord. And then the one discordant note, let sinners be consumed from the earth, and let the wicked be no more. And he realizes, a psalmist, in looking out at this whole world, which is extraordinary, realizes there's one problem. Sin is in this world. And yet, the psalmist, looking at the world, says, you know what? If we could just get rid of all the sin, this would be unbelievably happy and joyful. And that's the promise. And later on, it's one day there'll be the new heaven and the new earth. And if you aren't excited about it, you need to read Psalm 104 to imagine what this world would look like if the wicked were no more and all the evil had perished. Bless the Lord, O my soul, which is exactly how the poem opened. Bless the Lord, O my soul. praise the Lord. I mean, this poem is extraordinary in so many ways, but the big lesson is God rejoices in this world. He rejoices because it's extraordinarily amazing. And if God rejoices in this world, I should rejoice about this world too. I should think this thing is amazing because God thinks it's amazing. And all the things that feel like terrors, the lions, God created them. He created the orcas, right? He created all this stuff. But he also created the giant cedars of Lebanon. He planted them. He has places for everything to live. He has times and he has seasons and the waters and all of these things. And we should just be wandering around all the time meditating on how amazing this all is, because God wants us to think, this is amazing. And you want to bless God? Here's how you bless God. You meditate on how amazing this creation all is. But the other really incredible thing about this creation, we often think about sort of amazing creation. And when we talk about it, we always imagine the majestic vistas, the Grand Canyon, or sort of giant mountains or things like that. This is an entire meditation on nature, but all the nature here is very functional. This is an image of a world that is just functioning. It's like a giant machine in a way, right? It's just functioning here. Everything, the water is provided, not just so I sit down and stare at beautiful water, but because that's where we get water, right? That's where all the wild animals get water, right? The grasses grow so that we have food, right? All of these things are happening, right? And it's a very much an image of the glories of nature, not for 21st century Americans who live in cities and periodically go visit nature. This is an image for people that live in the countryside, growing constantly. Everything is hard, right? You're surrounded by all this nature, and it feels very mundane and boring. And what the poet is saying, oh, it's not mundane and boring at all. This is the image for us, and the challenge for us is when you look outside your glass-paned window in your heated house and you see the tree sitting outside with no leaves, to realize that's the thing God created and put there, and God's really thrilled about that tree. God loves that tree. And you know what we should do? We should love that tree too and be so excited that it's going to get leaves again in the spring, and so excited about how all this works and the trees are drinking their fill and the waters are flowing around and the wild donkeys are drinking. If we could capture that and be excited about that and meditate on this, ruminate about it, reread it, think about how amazing God is, that will be pleasing to God. God is thrilled, and he wants us to share that joy. Let's pray. God, we thank you for this amazing world you created. And God, we thank you that everything has its place, and everything has its time, and that, God, you created it all to be as it is. And God, we earnestly look forward to the day when the wicked is banished and sin is no more, and we can just see your creation with your eyes as this incredible thing that causes you to rejoice and causes us to rejoice. In Christ's name we pray.